Hi, everybody. My name is Rob Mason. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the Program of Recovery I found in this book, I've not found it necessary to take a drink since the 7th of July, 1988. For that, I am extremely grateful. It's good to be here. This is the fifth week of our 10-week series on the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the Program of Recovery that's found therein. And hopefully those of how many people have made all five so far? You're going to get a special prize at the end. Okay, that's good. Get a hearty handshake from Kathy. Okay. We're going to start on page 31 today. I told you last time that I always miss something, one thing, every week. Then I have to go back, realize what I missed, do a little backtracking. And this is something, you know, I see the more you read the book, the more you kind of dig down into it and really dissect it, the more you learn, the more you realize that you have to learn. And one of the things that jumped out at me this week during my reading was on the top of page 31 where it says, "We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there's been a brief recovery followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there's no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet." You know? And you know, it's so funny that they're always trying, aren't they? Right? Science is always trying to come up with a way to make alcoholics of my type like other people, you know? There's recently, I don't know if you've seen the ads on TV for the guy that says that he can cure your alcoholism in 3 months. Read this book and you'd be cured in 3 months. See, that's the kind of stuff that would keep me out there for years and years and years, you know. And they really believe, you know, and they obviously know a lot more about alcoholism now than they did in 1939 when they wrote the book. They've actually identified the gene, the trait that makes it possible for people like me to become alcoholics and people like them out there to not become alcoholics. And there's still a belief that they're going to find a way someday to make a pill that's going to make guys like me be able to drink normally, right? Now, let's just go down that road for a minute, okay? This is what I was thinking about this week. You know, if you really start to think about that, you know, First of all, I've never yet met an alcoholic who wanted to drink like a normal person. You know what I mean? I don't want to drink like a normal person, you know? I don't want to have the trouble that I get into, right? I still want to drink the way I've always drank, but I don't want to have the consequences that come along with it. And let's say they did come up with a pill to cure alcoholism, right? I mean, my first thought is going to be, well, if one makes me normal, what'll two do? You know what I'm saying? I mean, there'd be people in this room right now be snorting them, shooting them, using them as suppositories, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that's just how we are, you know what I mean? That's just how we think, right? So I don't know that they're ever going to be able to accomplish what they're setting out to, but they, God bless them, let them keep trying. All right, we're going to go to page 44. We're going to start talking about God here. Because now, by this point in the book, through the doctor's opinion in the first three chapters, they've talked a lot about alcoholism. They've talked a lot about the allergy and the obsession, the insanity, what happens when we drink, what will happen if we try to stay sober without having this vital spiritual experience. And as I said at the end of the session last week, Bill knows something that if we're reading the book for the first time, we don't know. That in about 16 more pages, he's going to ask us to make a very important decision. Okay? And it is very hard to make a third step decision if you don't have a belief in God. Or if you have this belief in God that shuts you off from the ability to have a relationship with that power. Now, I don't know about anybody else in here, but I had this vision of God when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my vision of God was impressed upon me as a child. And I believed that God wore this long white robe and he had this big cane for grabbing people who did things that were wrong. And he had a big, thick book, right? And in that book was written all of the bad stuff everybody had ever done, right? And I knew by the time I was about 14, I had a whole chapter in that book dedicated just to me. And so because I believed that, a relationship with this God was impossible because I wasn't sure I wanted to have anything to do with God based on what I believed, and I was darn sure that he didn't want to have anything to do with me. You know, so what Bill does in this chapter, most books written on spirituality will tell you certain things about God or try to convince you about certain aspects about God. Bill doesn't do that. All he's going to simply do, because again, remember, he wasn't a religious guy when he wrote the big book. He hadn't been to, you know, parochial school. He hadn't done any of those types of things. So what he's going to do is he's just going to try to give us some new ideas about God. And the whole idea is hopefully by giving us some new ideas, we'll be able to set aside our old ideas about God so that when we get to page 60 and they begin to ask us to make this decision, that we'll have learned enough and gotten a new idea and set our judgment aside enough that we can make a third step decision. Does that make sense to everybody? All right. So Bill has spent 53 pages, 44 in the text and another 9 in the doctor's opinion, trying to convince us of a couple of things. Number one, that I have an allergy. Okay, I have a physiological allergy, which means I get this phenomenon, a craving, that develops in me when I drink that never occurs in the average temperate drinker, the book says, and that I have this obsession of the mind that convinces me, and we talked a lot about that last week, that convinces me of things like, if I take an ounce of whiskey and mix it with my milk, it surely couldn't hurt me on a full stomach, right? Like, I'm sure that after a perfect day without a cloud on the horizon, I could have a couple of highballs after dinner, and things like that. You could fill in the blank. I mean, you know, as I shared with you last week, I got this great idea one time that if I brewed my own beer, that I could drink it, because somehow that was different than buying it in the store, right? And these are the kinds of thinking that dominate people like me, right? These are the kinds of thoughts that I have that the average person sees and says, are you kidding me? After what you just went through? You know, you just got out of detox. You just got out of treatment. You've been to jail. You've lost your family. You've lost your job. You know, I mean, what are you thinking? You know, and I don't have an honest answer, right? And so they've convinced us of these two ideas. And now he's going to begin to sum up what we've learned in the first three chapters right here in the first paragraph. It says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. Everybody circle that ism part, right? I have alcoholism, not alcoholism. Okay? Very important idea. Okay? Now, they're talking about the illness of alcoholism here. Okay? And so, from this point forward in the book, they're not going to talk anymore about the illness of alcoholism. Okay? From this point forward, all the way through the end of chapter 7, the rest of the book is all about where and how we're going to find this power that they're going to begin talking about. It says, we hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Okay, let's stop right there for a minute. If you have been through this workshop or you are reading this book on your own for the first time, hi Kip, and you're not clear on that, and you've reached this point in the book, my recommendation to you is that you go back and read it again. Okay? Because they're not going to talk about that anymore, okay? Especially focus on, if you're new, pages 20 and 21, where they talk about the types of drinkers. Remember that, okay? Where they talk about the social drinker, okay? And then they talk about a hard drinker, okay? And then they talk about, well, what about the real alcoholic, okay? So if you're not clear on those things, you ought to go back and reread that. And now he's going to sum it up for us by giving us a two-question test on alcoholism. So if you're sitting here today and you're wondering whether you're one of us, and when I get a new guy who's not 100% sure whether he's one of us, I take him right here to page 44 and ask him these two questions. Let's see what it says. It says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Everybody circle that word. Very important word. Entirely. Or, here's the second question. If when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, it says you are probably alcoholic. So they allow us a little wiggle room there if we want to get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. So if when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely, right? And that was always my problem, right? My whole problem was I could never quit everything entirely. You know, it says in the doctor's opinion that if I use alcohol in any form, right? And for me, that means other substances, okay? Because they always bring me back to alcohol, right? They always bring me back. And I always try the process of substitution, but it always leads me to the same place, right? But I could never quit everything entirely. And I tried lots of stuff, I tried lots of stuff. I tried therapy. I tried religion. I talked to this priest who prayed with me, right? And, you know, truthfully, you know, I was really wondering where they hid the communion wine. That's what I wanted to know, really. You know what I mean? So I figured if I could have a little communion wine, I figured it was blessed, and so therefore it wouldn't, you know, have the same effect on me. But I would start out, I would go into detox 3 or 4 days, try to dry myself out, treatment, 30-day treatment centers, you know, hospitals, etc. We've all been down that road, you know, and I really believed every time that it was going to be different this time. And I don't know about anybody else in here, but the nature of my illness is that I start out going into a period of abstinence with this very high resolve, right? And I'm sure that this time is going to be the last time. How many people here were sure this was going to be the last time, right? Was it? No, I didn't think so, okay? Yeah, I was sure every time that this was going to be the last time, right? But as I shared a couple weeks ago, for me, not drinking feels like I'm doing time, right? That's how it feels. See, I don't get happy, joyous, and free when I stop drinking. I get restless, irritable, and discontented, right? And the longer I stay abstinent, the worse it gets. And it's like sandpaper. And what would happen for me is the longer I'm sober, hour after hour, day after day, I just start to get a little anxious. You know what I mean? Just a little irritable. Just a little, like a little low-level depression. You know what I mean? And then I just start noticing stuff. You know what I mean? People just irritate me, you know? And I just notice what's wrong with everyone around me, right? I've been that way in AA. I don't know if any of you have had that experience, you know? Where you just notice what's wrong with everybody in the meeting, right? And see, here's the thing. The funny part about it is when I'm like that, I don't think it's me. I think it's all of you, you know? You all look very sick to me, right? And I'm glad I'm not any of you, you know what I mean? I'm glad I'm the one that has it all together, right? And I think this way, and I can't see it. I can't see that I'm the one that's screwed up. And that's why I am so grateful for sponsorship, and I'm so grateful for people in this program who I trust their judgment even when I think I'm right, you know, even when I think I'm right. Because sometimes I think I'm right and I'm absolutely not right, you know. And I like to be right. I like to be right. And so the longer I'm sober, I have this high resolve, and day after day, it's wearing me down, it's wearing me, and it just grinds away my resolve, right? Until one day, and sometimes it's 3 or 4 days, right? Something happens, I have a big blow up and I go out and get drunk. Some days maybe it's longer, right? Some weeks maybe it'll last 2 weeks, maybe a month, you know. One time I think I stayed sober for a month. You know, I had done something really bad had happened, you know what I mean? And I got in a lot of trouble over something. Like I ended up in jail and, you know, I said, that's it, you know. And I managed to get through it for a while, you know. But sooner or later, if you're like me, there's always some reason good enough to take a drink, you know. Some reason good enough to take a drink, and I drink, so I can't quit entirely, you know. Sometimes we try pills, we try going to the doctor, maybe they'll give you some sedatives or something like that. I've done that too, you know. And that works for a while, you know. It takes the edge off for a while, you know. But eventually, it always leads me back to drinking, you know, because it lights something within me. And then it also says that. If you have little control over the amount you intend to take, and that was always true for me, I could never predict, and if you're like me, what would happen when I took the first drink, you know? Now, from the first drink that I took, you know, occasionally I could control it, you know? Occasionally, if I had a really good reason, I could say, 2 drinks, that was it, you know, and I'll wait till I get home, and then I'll really drink, you know? But most of the time, even if I had a good reason, that was not the case. So I fit both of these criteria. And the book says that if you're like that, if you're like me, if you drink like that, you are probably an alcoholic. And I just love the simplicity of our book. You know, you're not sure you're an alcoholic, answer these 2 questions and you'll see for yourself. But alcoholics love to complicate stuff, don't they? Right? So somebody a few years after the book was written decided that 2 questions wasn't enough. Right? So they expanded it to 5 questions. right? And then a few years after that, somebody else expanded it to 12 questions, and they put it in a pamphlet that looks like this. Anybody seen this, right? And I love some of these questions, right? Like, for example, here's one that says, has drinking caused you trouble at home? Going on the assumption that we're fortunate enough to have a home when we get here. Right? See, I would have said no to that because I didn't have a home. Do you have blackouts? I always used to say none that I can remember. And I love this. This is one of my favorites. Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not drink? Hell no, I didn't feel that way. You know? I knew my life would be terrible if I stopped drinking, right? I knew it for sure, right? There used to be a question in here. They've updated this. One of the questions was, have you ever turned to an inferior environment or lower companionship as a result of your drinking? And I always used to say that I couldn't say that, but probably people said that about me. I was the lower companionship, you know? There's a guy out of Texas that Willie probably has heard of. Where's Willie at? Is he around here somewhere? There he is. This guy named Wino Joe. You know Wino Joe, don't you? And Wino Joe had been around for a long, long time. And Wino Joe got a little resentment about these questions. He didn't like these questions, right? So he didn't think this was an accurate picture of what an alcoholic looked like. So he decided he was gonna come up with his own questions, right? One of the things that he thought might be a sign that you were an alcoholic, he wanted to know, have you ever been arrested while you were in jail? He thought that might be a sign you were an alcoholic. Another one was, he wanted to know, have you ever had a sunburn on the inside of your mouth? He thought that might be a sign you were an alcoholic. And the third one that I, and this is my favorite one because I have an alcoholic wife who this actually happened to. He wanted to know, have you ever been run over by a car that you were driving? Yeah, you have to ask my wife about that one, right? All right, so now that they've asked us this two-question test on alcoholism, they bring us right back to the common solution that we talked about on page 25, okay? And the next sentence, let me tell you something. Don't read it. Don't get ahead of me. The next sentence, in my opinion, is the most important and overlooked sentence in the entire book, Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's going to tell me right here how I'm going to conquer alcoholism, okay? It says, if that be the case, if you fit these two criteria, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Not meetings, not my sponsor, not the fellowship, not the dance, okay? If you're an alcoholic like I am, if you fit the criteria of what they've been talking about in the first three chapters, all of those other things that I just talked about may be good, they all may be helpful. And thank God for our families and our friends and our meetings and all of that stuff. But if you're like me, you're suffering from an illness, the book says, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Right? Now, that's the truth. Okay? That's what the founders of our program believe. I want to read you something from this book called As Bill Sees It. It used to be called, we were talking about this before the meeting, this book used to be called The AA Way of Life. Right? And then after Bill died, they changed it, right? They didn't have the guts to do it while he was alive, but after he died, they changed it. But this is, I want to read you a couple quotes out of here that goes along with what we just read here, okay? This is from page one, okay? Page one must be pretty important, right? They put it on page one. It says, anyone who knows the alcoholic personality by firsthand contact knows that no true alky ever stops drinking permanently without undergoing a profound personality change, which we call a what? Spiritual experience, right? This is from page 171. This is a letter he wrote in 1955. Okay? It says, we know that permanent sobriety, again, that's my goal. Remember that. Permanent sobriety. That is my goal. Okay? Now, I stay sober one day at a time, but my goal is permanent sobriety. That's why I'm here. Okay? It says, we know that permanent sobriety can be attained only by the most revolutionary change in the life and outlook of an individual, by a spiritual awakening which can banish the desire to drink. Okay? So we've heard the same thing twice here and once right here in the big book. I suffer from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now, if that's the case, okay, Why don't we share that with new people? Why don't we discuss that at meetings? How many people here have sat in a meeting in the last month where the subject was a spiritual awakening is the only solution to the illness of alcoholism? One person. He's from Akron. That doesn't count. Well, you know, and we tell new people all kinds of stuff. And I'm not trying to be critical here. I'm really not, okay? I'm not trying to be critical. I'm going to tell you my experience. My experience was when I was new, again and again and again and again and again, they told me things like, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Go to meetings and don't drink in between. Meeting makers make it. Don't get in any relationships. Don't make any major changes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I did all that stuff. And I kept getting drunk. And I didn't understand why. And the point I'm trying to make here is if the only solution for a guy like me is a spiritual experience, then that's critical information for a guy like me to know, isn't it? Right? That is life-changing and life-saving information. And if I'm not sharing that with the people that I sponsor, then I am doing them a disservice. Right? I am doing them a disservice. And I am grateful that I finally got a sponsor who explained the book to me and who told me, what does step 12 say? It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So what's going to give me this spiritual awakening? These steps, not the fellowship, not my sponsor, not my friends. They're all great. They're all helpful. But the only thing that's going to give me a spiritual experience is as a result of these 12 steps, right? So, moving on here. Next paragraph. To one who feels he is an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience, a spiritual experience, seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster. Especially if he is an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Everybody circle that. Remember, we've been talking about alcoholics of our type, the real alcoholic, right? The hopeless variety alcoholic. The chronic alcoholic, okay, they all mean the same thing, okay? They all mean the same thing. And then it says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death, step one, or to live on a spiritual basis, step two, are not always easy alternatives to face. Wow. You know, it's interesting to me, you know, to be doomed to, you think about it for a second, to be doomed to an alcohol, not just a death, an alcoholic death, right? Think about what that means. An alcoholic death, let me tell you, and I've seen it myself more than once, unfortunately. And it is one of the worst kinds of deaths, okay? Because by the time you're dead, you have suffered, most cases for years, okay? And everyone and everything you have ever cared about hates you and they're glad you're gone. That's an alcoholic death, right? And most of the time you die alone, and most of the time you don't even know you're going. Okay? That's a horrible way to go, isn't it? Okay? But it says here that despite that, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis aren't always easy alternatives for people like us to face. Right? Now, why in the heck would that be? Right? You would think, logically, that it would be an easy choice, wouldn't you? Right? You go down to the cancer ward, okay? The critical cancer ward where they're dying of cancer, right? The terminal ward, okay? And if you were to go in there and say, listen, cancer patients, we've got this program, and would you all be willing to do a few things, maybe, you know, get down on your knees and say a prayer and ask God to come into your life and write down a bunch of stuff you were kind of ashamed of that you'd done and maybe go talk to another person about that and go out and maybe make some restitution to people that you'd hurt. And when you're all done with all that, maybe go out and share that with other people. Would you be willing to do that if I could cure your cancer? What do you think they'd say? Yeah. Absolutely. They would beg you for the opportunity. Okay? But you go down to the Salvation Army, right down the street to the ARC, where I did a meeting for 4 years. Kevin used to go to that meeting. And those guys are dying too, right? A lot of those guys, I've known guys from that place that die, right? They don't think they're dying, right? And you tell them the same thing. We used to go there week after week after week. Tell them the same thing, right? Look, we got this program. If you'll be willing to do a few things, write down some stuff you're ashamed of, share it with another person, go out and make restitution and help other people, you don't have to die of alcoholism. They say, well, we're going to go watch TV. We'll think about it. You know what I mean? But the difference, here's the difference. You go back 3 months later, all those guys from the Salvation Army are gone. All those people from the cancer ward, they're all gone, right? Most of them dead, okay? You see, alcoholism will kill you just as dead as cancer, just as dead as anything else, right? But for us, it's not always an easy alternative to face. Here's what it took me a while to understand, that nobody wakes up one day and chooses an alcoholic death, right? Nobody wakes up and says, today I'm going to choose to die an alcoholic death. What an alcoholic death is for people like me is it's the default position, right? In other words, if I don't choose to live life on a spiritual basis by applying these 12 steps, then I automatically default into dying an alcoholic death. And you know how I know that? I know that through my own personal experience, because I've known enough people that refuse to adopt our way of life that have gone back out there and died an alcoholic death, right? So for guys like me, there is very little alternative, right? Very little alternative. All right. The next paragraph goes on to say, but it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope that we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact. We had to. Everybody circle that. Most of us don't get here by choice. We have to, right? I would love to tell you I decided one day I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to be a great guy and a good husband and father, and you know, I was just so disappointed about what I'd been doing that I decided to come to AA, right? And I loved your A&A meetings and your steps, and you know, but I didn't, right? You see, the only thing that forces a guy like me, the only thing that convinces a guy like me to come in here and do this work is suffering. That's it. I had to. And it's going to tell us a little bit later on that after I've exhausted all other avenues, after I've looked everywhere else, right, in the last analysis, you know, not the first analysis, in the last analysis, right? It says we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else, okay? We must find a spiritual, I wonder how important that is. That sounds like about middle of the road to me, doesn't it to you? Yeah, okay. Bottom of page 44, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago, but we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted, in fact, we could wish these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Let's stop right there for a minute. Anybody who has been to this workshop before probably already has this, but if you don't, at the top of page 45, if you choose to do this, I want to define a couple things that mean the same thing. Untreated alcoholism, okay, that's one way of calling it, spiritual malady, and unmanageability, okay? Spiritual malady equals unmanageability equals untreated alcoholism. They all mean the same thing, okay? They're all exactly the same. Right? Step 1B says that my life had become unmanageable. Right? We're going to talk about that in this chapter. That means aside from step 1A, most people don't know there are two distinct parts to the first step. Okay? Step 1A says, I admit I am powerless over alcohol. Why? We've been talking about that the first three chapters. I have a physical allergy and a mental obsession. Right? And then there's a dash. Everybody see that dash? Most people read that and therefore, as if to say, therefore, our lives had become unmanageable. But that's not what it says, does it? See, there's a dash, which means end of one thought, beginning of a new thought. That our lives had become unmanageable, which means that I can't handle life drunk. I'm powerless over alcohol. And I can't handle life sober because my life is unmanageable. See, if I could handle my life drinking, I'd be out drinking. right? And if I could handle life comfortably sober, I wouldn't be here. I'd be out living life comfortably sober. So what step one effectually tells me is I can't live successfully in either world, right? And that's why I have to have a treatment for what I'm talking about now. Untreated alcoholism, spiritual malady, or unmanageability. Because that's how I get when I'm forced into a state of abstinence. And Bill is going to start now talking about, we've talked about the first two aspects of alcoholism. This is why I brought this up. We have talked about the physiological allergy and the obsession. Now he's going to begin to describe, right here on the top of page 45, what this spiritual malady, untreated alcoholism, or unmanageability looks like. He says in the next sentence, our human resources as marshaled by the will were not sufficient, they failed us utterly. Listen to what he says here. He says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. Everybody circle the word dilemma. We're going to come back to that. We had to find, so I have to find it, a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Shortest sentence in the book, obviously, right? But where and how were we to find this power? Okay? And that's really the purpose of the rest of the book up through chapter 7, is to tell us where and how we are going to find this power, right? And he's going to tell us specifically when we get to page 55 where and how we are going to find this power, okay? So right here, he changes my problem, right? All along he's been telling us we have a physical allergy and a mental obsession all the way through the first three chapters. And now he kind of changes the problem on us, doesn't he? He says, well, yeah, that's true, but our real problem, the true nature of our problem, is lack of power, right? Now, if I am powerless, what do I need? I need power, don't I, right? If my life is unmanageable, what do I need? I need management, don't I, right? And that's what the second step is all about, and that's what we're going to talk about in this chapter. As a matter of fact, we're going to talk about two different people. Okay, one guy who's self-driven and one guy who's God-driven, okay, that are described in this chapter. And they're both me. They're both me. At different, sometimes within the same day, they're me, right? I can go from one to the other very quickly, okay? But my problem all along has been lack of power. And I'll tell you what, still true for me today. You put me in lack of power, you will see my defects of character like that, right? About a year, well, it's been more than that now, about 2 years ago, my daughter was playing with a fish, right? Don't ever let your kids do that, by the way. And she dropped this fish, and it got stuck in her leg, you know? And she contracted this rare bacteria, right? And she almost had to have her leg amputated, right? So I'm in the hospital, right, in Arnold Palmer Hospital with my little girl, who's in the critical care unit there, right? And this, you know, all these specialists, and, you know, and it's not getting any better. They're giving her all this medicine. It's not getting any better. It's getting worse, you know. And I'm in lack of power, you know. I'm in lack of power, and I was a mess, right? And thank God for people in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because that is where you will see people like us struggle. In sobriety, right? And I can't drink over that stuff anymore, right? So you put me in that state, and it can be very difficult, right? So the book says that I have to find this power, right, that is not within me necessarily, okay? It says I have to find it, okay? I have to find it. And we're going to find out a little bit later on where we're going to find that power, okay? The next sentence says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object, so the main object of the book, is to enable you to find a power, capital P, greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. My problem being what? My problem being lack of power, right? Not just my alcoholism, my problem being lack of power, right? You know, I wondered for a long time why I did the things I did, why I hurt the people that I did, why I acted the way I did, why I believed the things that I did, right? And when I read this book, I got it. The reason I did those things is because I didn't have the power to do anything else, right? I did not have that belief, that relationship with God to change those behaviors. Self cannot overcome self. I had to learn that in here, right? Self cannot overcome self. If self could overcome self, I guarantee you none of us would be here, right? We would have just made a decision to get sober. That would have been it, right? You see, I didn't have, and the book tells me on the top of page 45 that my codes and philosophies were insufficient because I didn't have the power. I don't have enough power, right? So I need power and I need management. Next sentence says, that means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And it means, of course, listen to this, we are going to talk about God. Everybody underline that. Now, there is a philosophy in the pop culture of AA that wants us to believe that we shouldn't talk about God and Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? Now, the book does say that I should not bring up my particular religious beliefs. Okay? And I think that that is true. Now, I have religious beliefs. Okay? And I am involved in an organized religion. And guess what? I don't talk about AA at church. And I don't talk about church at AA. Okay? Now, if someone wants to ask me after the meeting, I'll be happy to share my convictions with tact and common sense, the book says. Right? But I talk about God all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when we get to page 48, it's going to tell us why it's okay to talk about God in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? Now, I don't know what book they're reading, but my book says that God 79 times in the text. Okay? So I don't know how you get away from talking about God in AA. Okay? All right. It says, here difficulty arises with agnostics. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship, but his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. For we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. Five most important words in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, we know how he feels. Boy, that was important to me when I got here. It was important to me to know, and this is a guy that for all of my life, all I heard was, we don't understand you, Rob. You are not like us, you know. And I came in here and people said, we understand you. You know, you're just like us. You're welcome here, right? So it's important, I think, for new people, especially important for me to believe that people know how we feel. All right, let's jump over to page 46. And right here on page 46, Bill starts giving us some new ideas about God that I talked about, right? Now, maybe they're not new to you, but they were new to me, okay? And it says here, in the first paragraph down, yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you that we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice, and that's prejudice is a preconceived notion or idea, okay? A preconceived notion or idea. He's going to use that word several times in this chapter, okay? That I must lay aside my prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we could commence to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. Now, that was a new idea for me, right? See, I thought I had to really understand God, right? I thought I had to really get my arms around God. One of the things that I think is a misconception in the fellowship of AA is that God, as I understand him, means I must understand God, right? Anybody ever fall? Yeah, that took me a while to sort that out, you know? See, the book tells me very clearly, I cannot fully, as a matter of fact, if I could fully comprehend God, it wouldn't be a big enough God for me, right? Yeah. Wouldn't be a big enough God for me, right? I need a God that is so intense and so immense and so omnipotent that I cannot get my arms around it, right? And that's what the book says. So I don't have to fully, as a matter of fact, the longer I'm sober, the less I understand God, not the more I understand God, because I understand how limited my perspective is, right? I understand how limited it is. But that was a new idea. It goes on to say, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. And as I said when we went through Bill's story, this was a new idea for me, right? Because I had been impressed with lots of different people's conceptions of God. And my problem has never been my own conception of anything. My problem was always with other people's conceptions of things, right? And Bill's saying, I need to lay all that aside, right? I need to lay aside all those preconceived ideas and thoughts that I have about God. And can I do that? And let me tell you something. And I don't have anything against any religion, and I did when I got here. Okay, and I'm not going to speak ill of any religion. Okay, But I can tell you this, it took me a long time and a lot of willingness to be ready to lay aside all of my preconceptions about God and all of my preconceptions about organized religion and all my preconceptions about different things that I came in here with. Right? Really, you know? It goes on to say, our own conception, however inadequate, everybody underline that, however inadequate, not only do I not have to have a perfect conception of God, I can have an inadequate conception of God, right? As long as it works for me. An inadequate conception. Wow. Thank God for that, you know. Thank God for me. But I will tell you that the longer I've been sober, my conception of a power greater than myself has changed. Every single year that I've been sober, you know. Every single year that I've been sober. Because the more I have this relationship with God, just like any relationship, just like a relationship with a friend or a spouse, that relationship evolves and changes. It goes on to say, as soon as. I wonder when that is. That sounds like now to me. Doesn't it sound like that to you? As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power, direction, that sounds like management, provided we took other simple steps. I wonder what the steps they're talking about. Steps 4 through 9, right? The action steps of our program, which we found out on page 25, are required to have a spiritual experience, right? It goes on to say, we found that God does not make too hard a terms to those who seek Him. That was a new idea. The realm of the Spirit is broad and roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding. To those who earnestly seek it is open, we believe, to all men. It goes on to say, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. Right? Again, second time that they've said it. Our own conception of God. You know, how many people here like to have it their way? Anybody here like to have it their way? Okay. Well, I've got good news for you. Okay. There are a lot of requirements and specifics and musts in the book, but this right here is the only place you can have it your way in Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? You can have it however you want it. Right? Now, I like that. It works for me. Right? All right. Let's jump down to the next paragraph, and then we're going to take a quick break here. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, and that's for the atheist, the one who doesn't believe, or excuse me, that's for the agnostic, he who has a belief but it's an uncertain or unsure belief, or am I even willing to believe, that's for the atheist, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as, I wonder when that is. As soon as a man could say that he does believe or is even willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he is on his way. On his way to what? On his way to a spiritual experience, right? As soon as I could say that I believe or that I'm even willing to believe, right? You don't even have to have the door open. All you have to say is I'm willing to open the door, right? That's enough to get on your way to working the steps. You know, one, and I've sponsored a lot of guys that are atheists or agnostics, and one of the ways you can kind of hook them if you're sponsoring somebody like that is you say, well, let me ask you a question. If you don't believe there's, you can't believe there's a power greater than you, no, I can't believe that. Okay, is there a power other than you? Let's start with that, right? Well, that's an obvious question, right? And so kind of get them that way through the back door, right? And alcohol is a power greater than me, right? I was just worshiping the wrong thing. We're going to talk about worship in the second hour. It says, it has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, everybody circle that, we're going to come back to that. Upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. What Bill's going to start doing here is he's going to start painting this picture of the spiritual structure that we're going to be building. Okay? And right here, he actually mentioned it the first time in Bill's story on page 11, where he says, upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend, his friend Ebby. And here we're talking about the first stone, this idea of believing or being willing to believe. And he calls that the cornerstone, right? And that's the stone that all the other stones rest up against when you're building a structure. Okay? So if your cornerstone isn't fixed properly in place when you build your structure, what's going to happen? It's going to fall, isn't it? Right? So last week, on page 30, we talked about the idea of the first step, didn't we? Everybody remember that? That I must concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. That's the first step in recovery. And right here on page 47, we get the essence of the second step. Do I now believe? Or am I even willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? If I can say that I believe or I'm willing to believe, I have now taken the second step and I am ready to learn more about finding this power. Let's take a 5-minute break.